Good day. I'm Larry Levitt with the Kaiser Family Foundation. Today, the Office of the Actuary in the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is releasing new estimates of total health care spending state by state. The estimates are being published in the journal Medicare and Medicaid Research Review, and they show how the almost $7,000 per person we spend in a year on health care varies throughout the country. We're going to dissect that variation and explore what's behind it and why it matters. We're joined by Gigi Kuckler, an economist and author of the new report, and also for reaction, two highly regarded experts in health policy and economics, John Hollihan, who directs health policy at the Urban Institute, and Dan Crippen, former head of the Congressional Budget Office and now executive director of the National Governors Association. You can submit questions for our panel during the show by emailing them to ask@kff.org. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Gigi, let's start with you. One conclusion from the report is that spending does vary quite a bit from state to state. And give us a sense of that variation. Where is spending high? Where is it low?
Sure. When you look at overall spending for personal health care per capita in the nation, we see some of the highest levels come out of the New England and Mideast regions, with the highest level of spending in Massachusetts, which spent more than a third higher than the national average. On the other hand, some of the lowest levels of spending are in the Rocky Mountain region, including Utah, which had the lowest level of spending, who spent more than a quarter below the national average. Now, as you'd expect, the trends are different for Medicare and Medicaid. For Medicare, rather, we see only 14 states with above-average spending, most of those coming out of the eastern United States, including the state with the highest level of spending, New Jersey, which spent 15% above the national average. On the other hand, in the western United States, you tend to see lower levels of Medicaid spending per enrollee, generally speaking, including Montana, which had the lowest level of spending. And, of course, for Medicaid, you see much broader variations. So instead of 14 states having above-average spending, you actually have 30 states with above-average spending, with some of the highest levels coming in, again, in the New England and Mideast regions, and the lowest levels coming in the far west and the southeast regions. The highest level of spending was actually in Alaska, though, which spent two-thirds higher than the national average. Lowest spending came in California, which spent more than a third below the national average.
Just to clarify here, we're talking about variations across states, but we're not just talking about spending that states themselves or state governments themselves.
Sure.
It's Medicaid, it's Medicare, it's people's out-of-pocket costs, what's paid for out of employer-provided health insurance, so really direct health care spending across the whole system.
Yeah, it's total personal health care spending. When we look at all payers, that was sort of the first part that I discussed. That's total personal health care spending. And then we looked at the components of that for Medicare payer and the Medicaid payer.
And why? I mean, if you had to point to two or three factors of why spending varies, what would those be?
Well, broadly speaking, for overall health care spending variation across the nation, we looked at some of the key characteristics among states with some of the highest levels of spending and some of the lowest levels of spending. So what we saw is states that had the highest level of spending tended to have higher per capita incomes. They also tended to have more elderly residents, whereas on the other hand, we saw that states with some of the lower levels of spending tended to have younger residents, lower incomes, and lower rates of health insurance coverage. As you might expect, things are a little bit different in Medicare and Medicaid. For Medicare spending, we looked at states that had the highest levels of per enrollee spending, and we saw that states that had higher spending tended to have higher shares of female enrollees, African-American enrollees, and relatively older beneficiaries. And, of course, for Medicaid, which had even broader variation, we saw that incomes also played a role. So we saw that states that had higher incomes also tended to have higher per enrollee spending. But that's really more of a function of sort of the economic availability of resources for those states. We also looked at beneficiaries there, and we found that states that had above-average spending tended to have above-average shares of enrollees that were blind or disabled or elderly. And, of course, since Medicaid is a state-specific program, we saw that, certainly policy differences and differences in benefit design are going to impact variation as well. So there are really a complex mix of factors that help explain the variation.
Yeah, complex is certainly right. and the estimates, the estimates you've been talking about are for 2009,
yeah.
But you also looked back 10 years. And did you see variation in how fast spending has been growing? Has there been some movement around low-spending states become high-spending states, high-spending states become low-spending states over time?
Well, yes, we did see that. We basically looked at growth over the last decade and sort of the impact that growth has on the relative position of states, or sort of the ranking of states. And what we saw is that states, well, the fastest growth, first of all, for overall personal health care spending was in New England region. Some of the slowest spending was in the Southeast region. And what we saw is that states that had some of the highest levels of spending historically actually grew faster than the national average, while states with some of the lowest levels of spending historically actually grew slower than the or grew on par with the national average. So we actually saw a broadening in the gap between the states with the highest level of per capita spending and the states with the lowest level of per capita spending over time. For Medicare and Medicaid, we saw, of course, a slightly different trend. For Medicare, we saw that growth was fastest in the Plains and the Great Lakes regions and slowest in the Far West. And for Medicaid, we saw actually fastest growth in the Southeast region and slowest growth in the Mideast region. But for Medicare and Medicaid, for both, we saw that over time, the gap between states with the highest level of per enrollee spending and the states with the lowest level of per enrollee spending narrowed somewhat. So despite this sort of narrowing for public payers on a per enrollee basis over time, the gap between the highest and lowest spending states overall on a per capita basis broadened.
John, let me bring you in here. And Gigi talked about the variation in Medicaid being larger than the variation in overall spending. Why do you think that is? Why would Medicaid spending vary more across states than overall spending?
Well, I think the main reason is the one she mentioned, which is that those states tend to have a higher share of their population that's aged and disabled versus adults and children, and that not only affects acute care costs quite a bit, but also long-term care. And the states in the Northeast and Midwest and some of the West just spend an awful lot more on Medicare, Medicaid dual eligibles, on long-term care services, and on acute care services for those populations. So I think that's by far the biggest.
And is this driven in part by demographics, just different population looks different in different states, or policy decisions states are making about
well,
eligibility?
It's that their populations are older, and whereas states in the Southeast and Southwest, there's been a lot of migration towards those states of younger populations, but that wouldn't do it by itself. There needs to be policy decisions that are going to support big long-term care systems, and by and large, you've seen a lot more of that in Northeast and Midwestern states.
We also, you know, in these discussions, we often think of healthcare costs as being bad. High costs are bad, low costs are good. Is that the right way to look at this here? I mean, is a state that has low spending automatically doing better than a state that has high per capita spending, whether in Medicaid or more broadly?
Well, as you know, that question's been debated. I had a very hard time believing that spending substantially less is going to do you much good. You can get to the point where increased spending at the margin has a very low payoff, but my guess is that within that range, that there is you're better off putting more resources into healthcare than not.
And Dan, would you agree? I mean, how do we judge kind of what the right level of spending here is?
There's no way to talk about an optimal level, but it does come back to the health of the patients or the beneficiaries. And it's certainly not a great correlation to say that those who spend less have healthier citizens or beneficiaries. But on the other hand, the literature also is pretty clear that spending more doesn't necessarily correlate with better health or better outcomes either. So there's no magic to the right level of spending. I mean, the longer-term trick, of course, to bring healthcare costs down is to have a healthier population. It is true that we tend to spend more on people who are less healthy and need more health care. So we can talk about inefficiencies and other things, but ultimately it's the health status of citizens that drive much of the per capita. One other thing on Medicaid, by the way, is that the payment to providers is one thing that states do have a significant control over at this point. And so you get somewhat anomalous results, like California having a low per capita cost for Medicaid, but they also have notoriously low payments to providers. So it's another piece that comes in here. There's going to be a change, of course, with the healthcare reform Act of last year, where we'll have essentially a national standard for Medicaid eligibility. Heretofore, the states have had a lot of say over who is eligible and what the benefit packages are. So that some of that variability will come out, and your next 10-year numbers will show a much different result, but a lot of it because of federal policy changes and coming to national standards.
So you think, let's tease that out a little bit. I mean, so looking at the effect of the Affordable Care Act, what so it sounds like you were saying that should narrow some of the variation across states. What's the mechanism? What are the factors that you think would cause that?
Primary one is who is eligible for Medicaid benefit. Currently, states have, before last year, established much of that. So in some states, it's less than 100% of the poverty level is the cutoff for eligibility. Other states, it's well above the poverty level. So who is eligible is going to become much more a national standard. 133%, roughly, of the poverty level, you'll be eligible no matter what state you're in. The second big variability is what benefits are covered, and there'll be much more inclination for a standard benefit package, although we'll still have some variability, but the cost should be roughly the same. So two of the big pieces will be taken out, two big pieces of variation will be taken out by the Health Reform Act.
And John, you agree, looking ahead to 2014 and beyond, that we should see the variation narrow?
Well, with one important caveat, I mean, all of this data, as I read it, was on a per enrollee basis. So what will happen with health reform is more enrollees in states that now have relatively few. So what will happen to per enrollee spending is harder to tell. I mean, I suspect it'll stay low. It hasn't really been growing at particularly rapid rates in Medicaid. So I guess I wouldn't see that. I'd like to say one thing about this issue of provider payment rates. Yeah, states can control that. But what I think we don't know is whether if you control, you know, say, have very low rates of physician payment, whether you have low acute care expenditures. And in the data that I've looked at, and it's, you know, not terribly sophisticated what I've done, but, I mean, you see very high rates of hospital admissions and expenditures in those states with low physician fees. They're, you know, like in New Jersey or New York, people are very reliant on hospital systems for their care, and that's expensive. And so it'll be interesting in 2014. We're going to raise physician fees. Is that going to cost us a lot of money, or is it going to bring care out of hospitals?
Do you think it's possible that raising physician fees could actually wouldn't necessarily lead to higher per capita?
It might not. And
we have, I mean, the history, too, of physicians and others, providers, being good at adjusting quantity around price. I mean, obviously, it's P times Q to get the cost, and we've had lots of attempts to change or manage prices and still not have much effect, or at least not as much effect as we thought it would on cost.
And Gigi, I mean, certainly we've been talking about Medicaid. The Affordable Care Act, people get coverage in multiple different ways, notably expanded eligibility for Medicaid, but also tax subsidies in exchanges to make private insurance more affordable. Looking currently now, how much of the variation across states can you pin on differentials in the number of people or the share of the population uninsured? I mean, if someone's uninsured, they use less services. How much does that factor in here?
Well, the level of uninsured, I mean, first, I should kind of just step back and say that since our estimates only go through 2009, we really haven't built in any effects of the Affordable Care Act, and we certainly haven't done any sort of supposition on what they would be by state. Because we do notice that there's sort of a high correlation between states with higher rates of uninsured, we would expect that those states would have an impact, more of an impact. From the Affordable Care Act, but really beyond that, that's outside of the scope of what we looked at.
The other thing, looking at the timing of your estimates, which were for 2009, it was as the recession was in full bloom. Give us a sense of what effect that had on state variations in spending.
So what we saw with the recession, I mean, the effect on personal health care spending per capita was pretty notable. We saw a decline in overall spending growth from 2007 to 2008 and then continued slow growth in 2009. And our report really focused on three areas with the regional impacts of the recession. And what we saw is that the effects were most notable in the Great Lakes, New England, and Far West regions. And for those regions, they experienced more substantial slowdowns in healthcare spending per capita. And really what we saw when we kind of dug in a little bit is that those regions tended to have higher job losses and more losses in health insurance coverage. Now, of course, when we looked at health insurance coverage, we excluded Massachusetts from New England since it underwent health reform in 2006 to expand coverage. So sort of the second area that we looked at was which states had sort of the least impact related to the recession. So really the Southeast and the Southwest region, while they slowed down, their health spending overall slowed down in response to the recession. They didn't slow quite as much as the other regions. And that kind of brings us into sort of our key finding as well, is that the severity and depth of this current recession caused health spending to slow rather immediately during the recession for every region across the United States, whereas in the previous recession in 2001, we saw that health spending actually accelerated during the recession. So there was really more of a delayed effect of the recession on health spending in the previous recession, where in the current recession, we just had an immediate slowdown, an immediate effect from the economic downturn.
Do you have any theories of why that might be the case? What was different here?
Well, with this case, it was just the tremendous job losses, as well as losses in insurance coverage. Because those were so severe relative to the last recession, it was a much quicker impact. And we also saw that in our recent health spending projections from 2010 to 2020 that we put out through Office of the Actuary.
John, what would you expect to happen after, I mean, as assuming we do pull out of the economic downturn, what would these numbers look like? Would you expect spending to then start to accelerate again? And
yeah, I guess I would, but I think we really don't understand why it's fallen off quite as much as it has. I mean, I think one difference between the two recessions is that prescription drug spending was really exploding back at around 2000 and years right after that, and that has slowed down a lot since then. So that's probably one thing. But to the extent it is due to people losing jobs, incomes going down, less ability to spend, people losing health insurance, going on Medicaid, which costs less on a per enrollee basis than private coverage, or becoming uninsured. We know people who are uninsured spend less. That's probably what's explaining it. To the extent that turns around a bit, it'll turn around health spending. But I sort of suspect that an awful lot of the smaller firms that laid people off, or if they didn't lay people off, at least dropped health insurance, very well may not go back. And in which case, I mean, let's talk about before we get to 2014. You know, that it may not pick up, spending may not pick up to get back to the levels that we were at before.
And Dan, I mean,
there may be other factors that are explaining what we're seeing,
especially the states.
Wait, what other factors might those be?
Well, the states have had a dramatic decline in revenue, unlike the federal government. High point was 2008. They still haven't recovered to literally the nominal level of revenues. At the same time, Medicaid enrollment, of course, has gone up because of the recession. And states have taken continuing actions to try and trim the per capita cost of Medicaid. And we have actually state legislators in special sessions, even as we speak, with some more Medicaid reductions on the table. So the state piece, at least, of Medicaid, there was, the stimulus plan. It had an increased FMAP for a couple of years for the states. That has now, of course, completely expired. But in the meantime, the states have also been trying to better control Medicaid cost increases. So there's been a real impetus, at least, on doing that.
And broaden beyond Medicaid here, how much control do governors have over health spending outside of Medicaid? Is this something that governors are just play the hand they're dealt, are there things they can do?
Well, they often do play the hand they're dealt, which could be tough, I mean, politically and otherwise within a state. But there are two pieces, I think, that are important to note. One is that all governments now pay for about 50% of all health care before you even talk about tax exclusion. And so governments writ large, federal, state, local, have a big stake in this and therefore have a big influence. I think when you look at state employees, state retirees, many states have the local employees, teachers, and others in retirement systems that are statewide. So there are big impacts of health care on the whole state. they, in theory, of course, have control over some of those costs. And one thing states don't recognize as much as they might is that often states, whether it's governors or not, have a lot of control over the supply of health care. And they determine the number of slots in medical schools, what the curriculum is, how many hospital rooms in many states, whether there's certificates of need for imaging machines, but equally importantly, what can the healthcare professionals do? It's called scope of practice, but if you let nurse practitioners or physician assistants perhaps do more things, like have a limited range of prescribing powers, just as an example, you might be able to kind of expand the supply of healthcare, which we don't talk about much. We talk about prices, we talk a lot about demand and utilization, but not much about supply. So I think states and governors need to think more about supply, especially anticipating we're adding some 30 million people through Medicaid and the exchanges to the healthcare system. We want them to use healthcare. That's the idea behind this, but we have to make sure we have enough supply to absorb those incoming beneficiaries.
And Gigi, do you see or have you looked at variations in supply now? I mean, physicians per capita, hospital beds, how much of that might drive some of the variation we already see?
Sure. We actually did look at some supply-side factors, number of hospital beds and physicians, and we did see a positive association with those factors and some higher levels of health spending. But one thing to keep in mind is that the reasons why there might be higher rates of them also may be related to relatively higher incomes per capita as well, which would attract more physicians. So we did look at it, and we did find that it was common for some of the highest spending states to see higher rates of physicians and specialists in particular.
And let's to a table full of economists, I think it makes intuitive sense to you that higher incomes lead to higher spending. I'm not sure it makes intuitive sense to everyone. John, why would it be that a higher income state would necessarily have higher healthcare spending than a lower income state?
Well, I think if people have higher incomes, they're going to want more of most things, and health is valued greatly, and people will spend more. I mean, usually when people say we spend more when we have higher incomes, they're controlling for health status. I think, you know, if higher income people are healthier and you don't control for health status, you may not see that strong an effect. But I think most of the time people do that.
So this is almost a state-by-state variant of what we see with international comparisons,
right,
where higher-income
exactly.
countries spend more on health care
right.
as well.
I think in their regression analysis, they see a pretty
mm-hmm.
strong
Yeah, with one of the strongest.
Yeah.
Well, we have some questions from the audience, and let's move on to one. And one is about the state variation and cost of living differences across states. And Gigi, when you looked at factors, how much does that play in, the fact that it just costs more to do everything in some states than others?
Sure. Well, you've actually touched upon one of the most challenging parts of our analysis. You would think that would be a relatively easy adjustment, but when you look at incomes, you can find state-by-state data sources for state-by-state per capita income. But on the other hand, there's not really a good data source for health sector prices on a state-by-state basis. So really, income captures two effects. It captures sort of the relative ability of state of residents in states to spend on healthcare, but it also reflects a measure of cost of living. So the higher the incomes tend to be in a state, the higher the cost of living tend to be in a state. So that's really the way the pricing kind of plays into it and how we accounted for it in our analysis.
So it's in some sense hard to tease out the difference between the fact that higher income people spend more on lots of things and that costs are higher in those places.
Sure.
We've been talking a lot about Medicaid, not surprisingly, because we're talking about variation across states. But obviously, the private insurance side represents a substantial portion of spending as well. Dan, how much, looking at state-by-state variations, how much would you expect differences in the private insurance market to play in here? Are there differences between what private insurers in California do versus what private insurers in Alaska or North Dakota
sure.
or wherever?
Sure, there are a lot of variations. The states still regulate much of the health insurance market, and so part of that variation can be attributable to differences in that regulation. Whether there are community rating rules, for example, that you can only have so much variation among your premiums, what the benefit packages are, Probably more significant is kind of the historical patterns of use of health care. We have the example of course, Kaiser and where it had provided health care and what effects that have over the long term, and that's very regional, if not state. So there's lots of variation due to state regulation as well as tradition and practice patterns that are embodied in the state regulation.
And John, how turning back to the Affordable Care Act and health insurance exchanges that come into place, how would you see that changing the health insurance market and then playing out in turn in some of these spending trends?
It'll vary a lot by state. States with lower income populations and higher uninsured rates now are going to really see very large increases in coverage. A lot of other states really won't see that much. And that should put more pressure on the system, and it'll lead to higher overall expenditures because you have more people with insurance. But to the extent it causes price increases, that will add to it. But that's complicated because it really depends on how the ability of insurers to control the rates of payment and other payers to control rates of payment. And it's not a simple demand and supply. You know, demand goes up, prices are going to go up. It isn't that simple in healthcare. And I think one of the things that we're seeing more and more as a big factor in cost growth is the consolidation among hospitals. And you know, where you have big systems that are developing and buy up smaller hospitals and then negotiate as one. And it's very hard for insurers to negotiate with them. And so you have where you have states that are really dealing with that, it is very difficult for their insurers to control their premium growth.
And how, Dan, from a governor's perspective, is that an issue that they're looking at, facing, have any control over?
Well, they may have some control through local standards and state antitrust laws, but it more they rely on the federal antitrust mechanisms, especially when you have these larger systems who are across state lines. So, again, that's not something they have thought about a lot, antitrust initiatives of their own. But the state attorney generals, who often get together on various things, have had some discussions about it. I don't anticipate anything coming of that yet, but it's certainly something that they could take on and try and prod more antitrust kinds of considerations.
So we talked about Medicaid, talked about private insurance. Medicare is obviously the third big piece. And Gigi, you talked about the variation in Medicare. If you could just turn back to that. I mean, Medicare is a national program with less variation in policy across states, but there is still variation in spending. What drives that variation in Medicare spending across states, even though it's the same program everywhere?
Well, in this case, we really saw that there was a lot of variation in the beneficiary populations by state. And we did notice that states with above-average spending tended to have higher shares of female enrollees. And likely they're also older since women have a longer life expectancy, so that's not really surprising. In addition, we did find that higher shares of African-American beneficiaries were also associated with higher levels of spending. And this is a case where we saw that looking at several studies that show when that population is under 65, they have higher rates of uninsured. They also tend to be less healthy. So when they finally get into the Medicare program, they do tend to have higher levels of spending on a per enrollee basis. And so that's consistent with other analysis that we've done within the office. In addition to that, we also looked at sort of the breakout of age groups within the beneficiary population. And certainly beneficiaries that are relatively older tend to spend more, and that's related to sort of that end-of-life spending that we see in Medicare that's very notable and there's been a plethora of research on.
John, how about on the provider side? I mean, there's certainly, as Dan pointed out earlier, spending is P times Q, price times quantity, or price times utilization in this case. And you certainly see differences in utilization even in a uniform program like Medicare across the country. How much of that, do you have a sense how much that drives these differences in expenditures?
Well, there are differences in prices, as you know, because we adjust for geographic cost of differences. I think there are clearly differences in utilization that are driven by, the availability of providers, particularly specialists, and teaching hospitals, have some effect. But it's also Gigi alluded to the health status differences, and they differ quite a bit, and that's related to demographics, incomes, poverty, the percentage of, say, a state's population that's really low income. I think all of those things will...
Not to divert back to Medicaid too far, but as John observed, there are interrelationships. You pay providers less under Medicaid. They may tend to use hospitals more. So for dual eligibles who do, we're eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare, the programs are bifurcated. Medicaid doesn't have to pay for most of the acute care hospitalizations for a dual eligible. And so you may pay doctors less under Medicaid, and if John's hypothesis is right, you drive more into hospitals which Medicare pays for. So some of the variation may actually be a function of the Medicaid program as well.
We got a question from one of our viewers about dual eligibles, people eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, and what states might be doing to control costs there. Is that a topic on the minds of lots of governors?
It is very much. It hasn't been heretofore, but because of the increased costs and reduced resources, they're looking at lots of things. And one of the facts is that the dual eligibles tend to spend a significant amount of money in both programs, both Medicaid and Medicare. So it is one way of thinking about treating the whole patient and getting rid of some of these adverse incentives between the two programs, and hold someone accountable more for the whole patient and the whole spending. It's assumed by most governors that if we did a better job of taking care of those folks, there would be some savings. And one of the discussions has been about how we share those savings between the Medicare program and the Medicaid program. State versus federal.
I assume you have
federal.
A view on that.
Well, yes. We do, but I mean, it's not. There's nothing magic about it. There should be some shared savings, and I think that's kind of our view and the specific formula yet to be negotiated. But duals are certainly a population that spend a lot of money, are some of our sickest citizens, and that if we did a better job of coordinating between the two programs, would probably give them better health, and we hope as an artifact of that save money.
John, give us a sense. I mean, for this group of dual eligibles, I mean, what kind of spending levels are we talking about compared to, let's say, other groups in the Medicaid program?
Boy, there's certain numbers I don't carry around in my head, but I would say $10,000 to $30,000 or $40,000, and then on up for a very small share. They are far and away the most expensive populations. For Medicaid, and when we look at Medicaid data, and that doesn't count the Medicare spending.
And many of these are folks in long-term care and nursing homes.
A lot of them are in long-term care, but there are a lot of people who are quite expensive who are not in long-term care facilities. And right. And so I think one of the things that is an interesting issue, and yeah, we are moving towards trying to figure out ways to manage the care, and there's been a lot of grants given to states and new authorities to put people into managed care plans and manage the care of all the services across both programs. And it's largely thought to be a Medicaid responsibility. Most of the studies that show that if you really manage the care, where the savings are going to be, they're really going to be in things that Medicare pays for. And so we've gone through a long period of time in which Medicare hasn't taken on that responsibility. Now we're going to have states manage it and be able to keep some of the savings on what would have been Medicare expenditure. So we'll have to see how this plays out. But we're not as successful in the demonstration programs at saving money on the long-term care side of things as we are in acute care.
One of the other Medicare and Medicaid issues that played out over the period the actuaries looked at was the implementation of the drug benefit in Medicare Part D, which took a lot of people who were previously having the drugs paid for in the Medicaid program and shifted it to Medicare. Give a sense how that played out in these numbers, how that shift.
Well, one of the things you see in the actuaries' numbers are that the growth rate in Medicare spending over the 2004 to 2009 period actually goes up, whereas in Medicaid it goes down. So the question is, if you had taken the drugs out of that altogether, what would those growth rates have looked like? I suspect that Medicare's growth rate probably would have gone down a little bit. Medicaid's probably would have gone down quite a lot in the recession, primarily because so many of the new enrollees are people coming in because they're losing jobs and they're adults and children, and you know, we're not probably adding that many of the more expensive agents disabled. So there's a compositional shift within Medicaid towards a less expensive population. So I think if the I would kind of really encourage you to try to do that because, you know, we really get a better picture of what's happening to those underlying growth rates on a per enrollee basis.
And Gigi, is that something you all have looked at?
We actually did. We looked sort of between the 2004 and 2009 period. And if you excluded which grew on a per enrollee basis at 2.3%, so that seems like it's below the inflation rate.
But that's in Medicaid, right?
In Medicaid per enrollee. Yeah. But if you remove prescription drug spending and you just take the per enrollee calculation without prescription drug spending, that goes up to 4.0%. So it which is pretty close, at least much closer to the overall personal health care spending per capita growth, which was 4.7% during that time.
And how about Medicare?
In Medicare, I actually don't have that number with me.
Okay.
We'd be happy to get that for you later on.
One of the things we've seen in Medicaid that underlies some of the trend you teased out was a more rapid substitution for generic drugs than we anticipated. So we're getting 80-85% substitution in many states for drugs that have generics, which is faster than we thought. Part of that, some of that's happening in the Part D benefit as well, but much more pronounced.
And what's driving that? Is that state policy changes?
Some of it's state policy. Some of it's the managed care companies who are running many of, for the moms and kids in particular, who are running the programs have figured out how to incent. We've got some differential copays, like they do in commercial populations, of a dollar or two difference between generics and others. And just state policy in some places who states won't pay for or will only pay a small part of a brand name if there is a generic substitute available.
Let's turn it. One of the challenges in looking at state variation, and Gigi, let me just clarify, this is not spending that occurred in a state, but it's spending on behalf of residents of that state, and that presumably requires some complicated adjustments. In the data you have, can you give us a sense of how that changes the numbers? How often are people in one state using services in another state?
I can give you kind of a broad sense of what we do. We start off with looking at provider revenues by state, and we get that data from the economic census, which is released every 5 years. Then what we do is we look at utilization patterns for Medicare beneficiaries, rather, and also for some private insurance enrollees. And then what we do is based on their utilization patterns crossing states, we adjust our provider data so that the final data that we have is more of a reflection of spending that takes place in a given state, rather by a state's residents, rather than the state, just the revenues that occur within a state. And, you mentioned an example before. We see a lot of that type of behavior definitely around Washington, D.C., and certainly it's more common in areas with larger urban populations. But generally, that's the feel for how it affects the adjustment and sort of where we saw a notable adjustment.
I want to turn back to some questions from the audience. They've been coming in rapidly. One concerns, we were talking about the effect of the recession earlier on healthcare spending. The question is, are there other factors, for example, higher cost sharing that patients are facing that may have predated the recession, may have occurred at a similar time to the recession? John, do you have a sense, how much of this, if you can, how much of this might be the recession, how much might be more permanent changes in the kind of cost-sharing that patients are facing?
I think it's a really good question. I think it's hard to tease it out of this data right now. It could be having some effect, but I suspect that declines in incomes, losses of jobs, losing insurance is really affecting private spending quite a bit more. You know, I certainly wouldn't rule that out. It's one of the factors for sure.
And Gigi, is that something you are able to look at in in your estimates?
Well, so this is sort of one of the limitations of the state estimates, is that really if you look at total personal health care for all payers, that's including PHI or private health insurance, that's including out-of-pocket expenses, and that's including Medicare, Medicaid, other public. And so we really can't tease out on a state level out-of-pocket expenditures. So when you kind of remove Medicare, Medicaid from our total personal health care spending, you don't really get a measure of, say, just private. It's really kind of an amalgam. But looking at it more from a broad basis at the national level, in our most recent health care projections through the next 10 years that our office puts out, we did note a trend in increased cost-sharing expectations and higher out-of-pocket expenditures. So that was something we did see, at least nationally.
We have another question that's back at you, and it references an earlier discussion we had about price versus utilization and how much of that is driving. And the question is specifically about Medicare. As John was talking about, the prices do vary across areas in Medicare, but based on a more formulaic basis, utilization varies as well. Can you tease out how much of the variation in Medicare is price and how much is utilization?
Well, in our analysis, since we are really working more with overall revenues and benefits, it's really more difficult for us to tease out price and utilization. And that's really a challenge that we have. So it's very difficult for us to say with a precise measure what level of utilization caused the variation. I mean, we can generally look at trends and we look at research that kind of helps guide us in our analyses. But in general, based on the way that the analysis is done using revenues and using benefits, it's very difficult to break out.
Got it. Okay. Let's talk about sort of looking ahead for the next few years. And I know your estimates don't address projections; they address history. But start with John and Dan. What are a couple things we should be watching out for over the next couple of years? We come out of the recession, the Affordable Care Act gets implemented. What if we were looking at two or three things and came back to these estimates two or three years from now? What would you expect to see?
I guess I would expect to see continued slow growth in spending until we're well out of the recession. Because I think the slowdown that we've seen really is related to job loss, loss of insurance, loss of incomes. So I think until those things turn around, I think it'll have its effect on health spending. I mean, we're talking about health spending falling. Remember, it's still GDP has fallen more, so health spending as a percentage of GDP is actually going up. At least it was the last time I looked. So, I think those kinds of economic effects will dominate for a while. Then we'll get closer to 2014, assuming the ACA is still around. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be coverage expansions and and other things that will become the new drivers. And if the economy is stronger and recovering expansion, so then I'd expect to see health spending to start going up. So.
Dan?
Yeah, I agree with John. And as he said, it's more complex than supply and demand. But one piece of this is we're going to give access to 30 million more people to some kind of insurance. And presumably they'll use more health resources, which is kind of the point of the policy. We want more people to have access. So that just the raw look at demand, and we're not, as I suggested earlier, probably doing enough analysis or more changes on the supply side. We're going to have cost pressures develop. And states continue to try and somehow cut, stand in the face of those pressures. So I expect that we'll see costs, as John said, after the recession, go back or continue in a kind of more historic or recent historic trends of being higher than they are now and well above increases in economic growth or any other factors we can think of. So I think the kind of inexorable increases in healthcare costs that affect all of our budgets, federal, state, personal, will be back at the fore. And as many of the folks who have promoted increased access understand fully, it may be an empty promise if we don't do something about the cost side of the equation. Whether people who now have access can first get to a doctor or other provider, but more importantly, can they afford it, and all of the consequences of that. So the whole discussion will come back, I think, in the next few years to cost, changes of cost, cost containment, whatever you want to call it, but more work on the cost side of the equation.
And what should, speaking as a policymaker, what should these numbers tell me? I mean, what lessons do I take from these estimates?
I don't know. Other than what we've already talked about, that this particular set of data tell you a lot that we haven't discussed. I do think it's important to understand we still are confounded more often than not on what are the real causality of both cost and increase in cost. It really is the increase we need to focus on, and as John said, we can take some solace in that decline, because many other countries who spend less than we do for and maybe get gooder, better care, but also are suffering some of the same increases and patterns of increases. So the base is only part of it. It's the rate of increase that is the worrisome part, if you will, for our future. So how we can analyze these differentials in increases, I think it's an important piece of research that, we've all said, we need to keep working on to tease out the causality and know more about why these rates are changing, why they're different between states.
And that's, Gigi, is that something you've looked at? I mean, we talked about the factors behind the variation, less so about the factors behind why one state might be increasing faster than another. Can you point to a couple things you've seen in the data that might suggest?
Well, I would say our analysis was really based on more of an association. So this is sort of a more technical aspect of the analysis. But the actual saying, it's a much stronger statement to say that any of these factors that we pointed to cause higher health spending. And we haven't really established that with the analysis that we've done here. We've mainly pointed out the characteristics of state that's tended to have higher spending. But it's a much stronger statement to say that, higher incomes causes higher levels of health spending per capita. And we certainly looked at some studies that tried to get at that, and we've noted that in our article. But that definitely is sort of the golden egg. And it's very, very challenging to really make that stronger statement.
And when Dan talked about the rates of growth in spending, give us a sense of what kind of variation. I mean, did a high growth state, let's say, grow 1 percentage point a year faster than a low growth state? What's the general range of?
Kind of looking more recently, we saw New England grew, I believe it was around a percentage point faster than the national average. Just in the national average, I believe between 2004 and 2009 was around 5.5 on a per capita basis. So just kind of broadly speaking, but you really can, depending on sort of which payer you're looking at, depending on whether or not you're looking at an amalgam, you could see sort of broader variation. But when you look at all payers, you're looking at higher levels of kind of aggregated data. And so when you do that, you kind of swamp the differences across the regions.
We also had another question from the audience about prescription drugs, and looking particularly at not so much the effect of the Part D Medicare benefit, but how prescription drug spending grew in general across all payers, and how that compared to previous years. How much of the increase we've seen over recent years is due to prescription drugs, and is that different from earlier periods?
Well, there's a few things going on, as we've discussed, with prescription drugs. We had the implementation of Part D, and for Part D, we saw that there was really more of a one-time impact on overall spending per capita on prescription drugs, so basically for all payers on prescription drugs. So we saw a one-time bump in 2010, and mostly that occurred in the western half of the country. So there was that sort of that aspect. But in general, we also saw that if you kind of look back earlier in the decade, compare that to later on in the decade, there's really a broader adoption of generic drugs that we see, and that comes in into lowering growth over the period from, I think it was over 12% down to below 6%. And really a big part of that is generic drug adoption. So you don't see, with Medicare Part D, that's really more of a one-time shift. Rather than an overall shift.
Got it. No. And thinking about, you know, more specifically at sort of the services that people use, and Dan talked earlier about the some efforts to increase supply, what effect increasing access to primary care might have. Have you looked at and kind of drilled down and looked at how states might vary, not so much in overall expenditures, but also what types of services people use? So do some states you see using more hospital care versus primary care?
Well, there's certainly a broad variation in the services as well. You know, in our report, we really focused more on some of the variations we saw on the services on a growth basis, looking at sort of more recently because there has just been so many things that have gone on. So as we said, we looked at prescription drugs. We also looked at some of the variation growth in physician payment growth, physician spending growth. There we did see faster growth in New England and, again, in Massachusetts. And really that we thought that was related to health reform in Massachusetts. We've seen that when you have expansions of coverage, there can be increase in demand of physician services, more so relative than some of the other services. And we also looked at hospital spending growth, too, in the latter half of the decade. And we did see that hospital spending growth, again, varied a little bit, quite a bit. We did see that was fastest. Again, I would probably want to just briefly check, but I believe it's New England.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And, John, you talked earlier about how physician services expanding, for example, due to health reform in Massachusetts, might not necessarily lead to overall increases in expenditures, that there might be offsets. Looking ahead to the Affordable Care Act being implemented nationwide, how might you expect that to change the composition of spending?
I guess that I, off the top of my head, would expect to see more use of physician services, particularly where the capacity is there to provide it, and probably fewer unnecessary hospital admissions, maybe more drug use because of the access to doctors. But I think that would be the main expectations that I have.
And Dan, is that consistent with what you might expect?
Yeah, no, and
to
I think when we suspect the same in Medicaid as it expands into this population as well as and there were things, of course, in the Affordable Care Act that tried to shift. Things away from hospitalization, some unnecessary or avoidable hospitalizations, payment changes of accountable care organizations, medical homes for Medicaid. So there was, a conscious effort to shift services more to physicians, as John said, and hopefully avoid more expensive and unnecessary hospitalizations. So.
But you're going to see a lot of variation. I mean, there are states where there's significant movement on the part of hospitals to buy up physician practices or to align with physicians, and there are certain reasons why that's not attractive to doctors. But one reason it is because they have particularly the stronger systems have a lot of bargaining power. This will give them more, so doctors could do better. And if that's where the expanded use of primary care services comes from, then you'll see more use in hospitals, and I suspect faster growth in those kinds of states. If it's outside and we're able to expand primary care practices and they're able to use physician assistants and nurses efficiently, you may not see the cost pressure. But I think a lot depends on how that delivery system changes. And I don't think right now we know, and I think if we know anything, it's not going to be the same everywhere.
Yeah, well, that's certainly been the theme here, is that things are not the same everywhere. Well, we're coming to the end of the hour, and I want to thank all of you. I think particularly with economic volatility right now and with implementation of the Affordable Care Act proceeding coming back here a few years from now when Gigi, I won't make you commit to when you're going to redo these estimates, but it might be a very good time to revisit some of these issues. So thank you, and thanks to everyone for joining us.
Thank you for having us.